number here in Sitka, 747-5877 or 1-800-478-5877 if you're calling from one of the smaller communities that tune in Raven Radio. But we're also going to have a presentation tonight from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, National Weather Service Warning Coordination Meteorologist Joel Curtis is going to be joining us over the phone from Juneau this evening to talk about a presentation that he gave to the local emergency planning committee. So you can reach us by phone. We'll be taking calls maybe in 20 or 30 minutes or so. You can also post a question on our Facebook page. Just go to kcaw.org and click on the Facebook tab if you're a Facebook member, and you can post your question that there. I've already started a thread. And while you're at kcaw.org, right there on the homepage, there is a link to a slideshow that Joel Curtis will be referring to as he gives his presentation, and you can follow right along. So anyway, that that should be fun, and it should be a chance for you to kind of share with your local emergency planning committee and Sitka officials and everybody else listening your experience during the tsunami. But first, let me say good evening, Sheldon. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Thanks a lot.
Has the dust settled in your department from the whole tsunami episode on January 4th and 5th?
We're still going through. In fact, we're doing a debrief again tomorrow morning to go through what we did well, what we didn't do as well. So not exactly.
Okay. Well, I'll be curious to hear how that goes. How about you, Al? How are things at the fire hall? Have you got the all the rigs put away and cleaned off and ready for the next episode?
Well, we got all the rigs put away, but they're not all up and operating, unfortunately. We did lose one engine that night.
Really?
The Public Works mechanic is working hard to getting that back online for us.
All right. And was that a result of, was it just coincidence, or was it a result of something to do with the evacuation?
No, it had nothing to do with the evacuation. It was just the transmission went out at that time, but fortunately it was on fire department property when it happened, so we were able to push it into the bay until he can get to it.
Okay. Well, I know I personally ground a few gears that night. It's just, I guess, when it rains, it pours sometimes. Dave Miller, things okay in the fire chief's chair?
We're still answering lots of questions about, you know, elevations of houses and what we should do and handing out pamphlets and stuff. But, yeah, it's all good stuff, so it's going very well.
Okay. You and Al also gave a report to the assembly the other night, and that was broadcast live over Raven Radio, and maybe we can have you guys kind of paraphrase that a little bit too when we get to that part. But right now we're going to try to take a desperate gamble. We're not sure if we're plumb to do this yet. Joel, are you there with us, Joel?
Yeah, sure am.
All right. Joel Curtis is joining us from Juneau. And Joel, I tried to get your title right. I just took a stab at it. You are the NOAA Warning Coordination Meteorologist, correct?
For the National Weather Service. And I am, Rob, I'm actually sitting in the chair that I was shook out of that night by the earthquake. This house was really, really shaking on the morning of January 5th, and I was woke up out of dozing in this chair and had my pants on, checked the tsunami warning site, and was on my way to work, and all in about a matter of about 3 minutes or so.
Well, you should have been asleep, young man. That's past our bedtime.
That's what they say, but maybe I knew it was coming or something.
You had some early notice of your own somehow. Well, Joel, before you get going on your presentation, I want to ask you, why are we talking to a weatherman about earthquakes?
Well, this is because the National Weather Service is responsible for the tsunami warning system. And the reason that it evolved that way was that the National Weather Service, prior to the establishment of any kind of tsunami center at all, had the infrastructure, the communications, and warning issuance capability, and it was just a natural fit to go ahead and take an oceanic warning like a tsunami and go ahead and put it in the National Weather Service.
And does it require any kind of specialized cross-training on your part, or do they just figure, oh, you guys are all scientists, you'll figure it out? How does that work?
Well, actually, I mean, all my academic background is in meteorology. Along the way, I picked up a bit of oceanography for a thing or two. But the way that I really got into tsunamis was right from the very beginning. I was stationed in Seattle, and the Washington coast there had tsunami responsibility. And everywhere I've been in the National Weather Service since then has had a lot of tsunami responsibility. So it's something that I've had to pick up on just for my career.
All right. I wanted to let folks know that you're going to be referring to slides in your brief presentation, Joel, that we have available on our website, kcaw.org. And while you're at kcaw.org, if you'd like to post a comment on our Facebook page to ask you, Joel, a question, or Sheldon Schmidt, or Al Stevens, or Dave Miller, you're welcome to do that as well. But Joel, why don't you go ahead and get started and give us the more or less the presentation you gave to the local emergency planning committee after the night of Friday, July 4th, or June, or January 4th, rather.
Everything started happening right around midnight on the morning of January 5th, and it was the morning hours where all of us were working very, very hard to get things done. But if there's any message that I want to leave the listeners with right now, it's that there is a tsunami threat. And what we like to think of as a local tsunami is a tsunami that from an epicenter or of an earthquake or some other phenomena that moves solid matter in water. This is something that we are very, very concerned about because we will never have the time to warn you in time. So if anybody at or near sea level feels an earthquake for 20 seconds or longer or has difficulty standing up, don't wait around. Get to higher ground. We will never have time to warn you in time for that situation. 20 seconds of an earthquake is going to seem like an eternity. And I always flash back to the video of the guy on the street in Japan during the March 2011 giant quake that they had over there, and the guy was just staggering. He just could not get to his feet. That is an extremely strong earthquake. Something will happen. Do not wait. Get immediately to higher ground.
Joel, can I interrupt you? Can I interrupt you on one thing, Joel? How do we know? I mean, 20 seconds is a matter of perception. I've heard lots of different people with lots of different versions of how long the earthquake was that occurred 2 minutes before midnight on the 4th. Do we know how long this quake lasted?
You know, if they went back and they probably looked at their seismographs, that would be the accurate answer, and I really don't have access to that information right now. I would say that what I felt here at my home in Juneau was about 12 seconds or so.
Okay.
So it was a pretty darn long earthquake, and maybe Al or Dave or you guys there could chime in and perhaps you had some good way of timing it, but I don't think that it lasted 20 seconds.
Any thoughts, guys, on what it was?
It's kind of interesting talking to the public. They've had everything from 30 seconds to 3 minutes. And when you talk around town, there's people who have their houses built on pilings versus slab and all these different types of constructions. So that may attribute to the time differences and how long the earth was actually shaking. When you look at the time that the Tsunami Warning Center actually did in seconds, it only shows 6 seconds for the actual time.
Yeah, I heard that too. It was astonishingly short, some data recorded. But I also checked on the I went to the Alaska Earthquake Information Center website today, and I was just looking at their earthquake tsunami preparedness pamphlet, which anybody can download. I downloaded some of it because there were some questions I wanted to ask you guys about. But they said that earthquakes may feel different to people only a few hundred feet apart due to all sorts of, you know, conditions below the surface. So anyway, Joel, I was just interested if you had heard anything, any information about about what a firm length of time might have been for our quake. But please continue.
Okay, on my slide number 3, I've got a very quick summary of the situation early Saturday morning, January 5th. The earthquake was initially measured at 7.7 magnitude. And when you have an earthquake that strong, the Alaska Tsunami Warning Center automatically warns an area of 300 miles around that epicenter. So they do not have time to determine if there has been a mass wasting, and that is some sort of underwater landslide or the block of a fault moved upward, any of the solid things under the water that can actually cause a tsunami. In this case, the earthquake epicenter was on what we call a strike-slip fault, and I'll show you a slide of that here in a minute. But when you have a strike-slip fault, and that is two plates of the Earth are moving either at different speeds or in opposite direction, but the shear between the two plates is horizontal and not vertical. So the main part of this Fairweather Queen Charlotte Fault in the zone where this particular quake happened is what they call a strike slip. And so this fault also at times behaves with some megathrust type dip slip kind of earthquake and behavior. But in this area where this epicenter was, it is really mainly a strike slip. So you absolutely need some sort of underwater landslide with this to go on. Now, Al sent me a really interesting email today of some modelers out of the University of Alaska Fairbanks that went back and did a prehistoric look at a landslide that happened along the same fault, and it was an absolutely colossal underwater landslide and may have actually caused a very, very large tsunami. However, this is not in the historical record, and really the tsunamis during written history on this one have not been very big, particularly in this from this particular area where this epicenter was.
Joel, how can you possibly determine whether it's a slip strike or a landslide? I mean, how do we get a read on the bottom of the ocean?
Well, there are certain waves that are set up by the earthquake, and the second of all is that there are many, many measurements made along this fault to look at the movement of these two plates. It turned out that in this particular quake, 50 kilometers of the fault moved. That's about, I'm just going to take a rough guess, about 35 miles or so. And that whole area moved 7 to 8 meters. So there was quite a bit of movement. It's something that they can measure. I'm not real sure how they do it, but I know that they can tell from their seismometers. And in places where the land intersects the fault, they do have, occasionally they'll have like a GPS unit or something like that to measure the movement.
Yeah, GPS GPS seismic sensors, yeah.
Yeah, and so there's... So there were lots of aftershocks with this. I believe we had a 5.5 this morning. The warning, the actual tsunami warning was issued immediately and was in effect for about 2 hours. The final determination of this quake was 7.5 magnitude, and if the Tsunami Warning Center had early resolved that 7.5, they would have only warned an area of 150 miles. So the Tsunami Warning Center is going to dash into action. They have no way of knowing if there was a mass wasting or big movement of solid matter that would cause the wave. So on slide number 4, there is an illustration of how the plates are moving around here. And I know it's kind of small and difficult to see. But on the right-hand side, there's an example of the strike slip quakes that we have. And they produce local landslides. There's no question that this kind of earthquake can produce a tsunami. But they're less likely to produce a tsunami than the dip slip earthquakes that are shown on the left-hand side of the slide. And those are usually more tsunamogenic. That means they form tsunamis because one plate is moving under the other. It puts stress on the top plate. The top plate is pulled down and then suddenly snaps back. And so the dip slip quakes are really cause more waves Pacific Rim wide. Now, the Yakutat plate, which is shown on the right of the center diagram, is moving to the north-northwest.
All right. Joel, I wanted to remind listeners that you are referring to slides that they can look at our website, kcaw.org.
That's correct.
This is Joel. Joel,
I happen to be on number 4.
Good deal. Joel Curtis is the NOAA Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Juneau. Go on, Joel.
Okay, so anyway, the North American plate is either moving slower or not moving at all, and the Pacific plate, where this earthquake formed, was moving to the north-northwest. So there's somewhat less likelihood that that type of quake would form a wave, and the way that it would form a wave only is if there was an underwater landslide. And there are also some short minor waves that do come out from any earthquake center. So now the next slide, slide 5, does show a simpler version of the local faults. And so we have the Fairweather Cape Queen Charlotte Fault offshore, and that leads into the Chatham Strait Fault that goes up and then becomes the Denali Fault that goes all the way up through Chatham Strait, all the way to Haines. And then the Denali Fault goes right on up to Denali, like it says. The two are connected by the Peril Strait Fault that goes actually through Peril Strait right by Pelican and Elfin Cove and then joins back with the Fairweather Fault at that point. So we do have, quite an active fault line here. It is causing earthquakes, as we've obviously found, because we had another one right in the dead center of the Queen Charlotte Islands back on October 27th, and went through at least somewhat similar type of scenario here, where the warning was issued immediately, followed up by some very close monitoring, and eventually canceled. Now, in parallel, on slide number 6, I wanted to show you guys a historical quake that was at least somewhat similar to this. In 1972, off Sitka, on the Fairweather Queen Charlotte Fault, we had a 7.6, and you can see the approximate area of this was just off the southern end of Khrushchev Island, and it was 7.6. Referring to slide number 7, it was on July 30th, 1972, magnitude 7.6, and it caused a very, very small tsunami at the Sitka tide gauge, which was only about 4 inches or so. However, I've talked to a person who witnessed this, a friend of mine, and she said that there was quite a tsunami out at Berry Island, and it was on the order of feet. So one thing I want the listeners to understand is that you can get quite a different tsunami from one beach or one location to another, and separated only by short distances. And a lot of this has to do with the energy in the wave, and how it comes up to the shore. A little bit more on this July 30th, 1972 quake. A few chimneys in Sitka fell. There were some minor landslides. Slight damage in Hoonah, Juneau, Pelican, and Yakutat. And in this particular quake, which had a higher magnitude, the Fairweather Fault moved 75 kilometers. There were seiches in swimming pools all the way in Seattle. 19 aftershocks through August 29th. And when we're talking about seiches, very interesting news report on KCAW News of the problems on both Deer Lake and Betty Lake at the south end of Baranoff Island, where having interviewed the very nice person, Covington, down there at Deer Lake, everything he described sound like it was a genuine seiche that went on at Deer Lake.
And a seiche is a high-dollar word for a lake tsunami, right?
It's used two ways. One is, just like you said, Rob, a lake tsunami, but also just hold up your favorite mason jar with about half filled with water and swing it horizontally back and forth. That sloshing motion is also the physics of a seiche.
And that's very...
That's
different from a landslide that falls into a lake and creates a wave.
Correct. Yes, very different, because a landslide is solid matter that will actually displace the water, whereas if the whole lake is moving, as I think was the case in the Deer Lake episode, Betty Lake appeared to have a landslide fall into it. And there were actually several, three avalanches, Carrington said, that fell into Deer Lake but did not penetrate the ice. So all of the evidence so far is pointing toward this as either being a seiche, or another possibility could be that it was a submarine landslide in Deer Lake.
Okay.
So, again, I think this being a bit stronger in 1972, it's still a pretty good parallel to this most recent event.
One thing, Joel, before you go on, I just want to quickly poll the room. Was anybody here in Sitka in 1972? None of us were even born yet in 1972,
right. Yeah,
Joel. Sorry about that.
But I was very fortunate to haven't talked to a couple of folks the last time I was in Sitka last fall that actually had been in this. One guy that had seen the damage in town, and another person who she witnessed quite a surge of water and run up onto the beach that pushed her boat up there.
I think it would be interesting to talk to some of the folks who did live in Sitka back then, and
well, for sort sure. Paul? There are people that actually do this as part of their job, is to interview people that have witnessed tsunamis to try and register all of this for scientific understanding. So I'd like to finish my presentation here with just a few factors that are going to cause the size of the wave at the particular spot you are. Number one, the earthquake magnitude is the strength of the event. So clearly, if a stronger quake is, the more potential there is for land movement, which will in turn affect the ocean, or if you happen to be on one, a lake. The second factor is the slope, or the submarine stability of the actual landforms that are along the fault where the quake formed. And if it is unstable material and can roll downhill under the water, that certainly will start a tsunami. So a submarine landslide is certainly the thing that gets going on a strike-slip fault like this. Everyone should understand that to get an actual wave, you do need a solid matter to displace. That is, some solid form. Even waves caused by extreme glacier calving are considered tsunamis. So something solid has to move in the water for you to get that wave. The depth is also very important for the formation of the wave. The deeper the ocean where this movement of solid matter occurs, the bigger the potential height of the wave is because more water moved. And finally, just the bathymetry of your own beach or wherever it is in your you are in the estuary can either focus or unfocus the wave itself as it comes in. So all of those factors make tsunami heights at very different places very different for the same event. So that's all I had to present tonight on the this particular event that occurred, and we'll be hanging on the line for some questions.
Joel, we had some follow-up questions here in the room. Al, you had one about aftershocks.
Yeah, Joel, you know, typically we have aftershocks that, that follow a fairly large earthquake. Is there any scientific data that shows what is a common time frame to expect these aftershocks to go on for?
Well, Al, it's a really good question, and honestly, I don't know how long the answer is. I do know that they can go on for weeks, but I don't know if there is a set time limit where you finally say, okay, that's all the aftershocks we're going to get. Anything else that occurs is now a new quake. I think that the seismic record, though, can tell them if these aftershocks are linked. And I heard the director of the Tsunami Warning Center today say to me that, you know, he's a little bit surprised that we haven't had actually a bigger aftershock, more like in the 6 magnitude range as opposed to the 5.5 that we had this morning.
Yeah, I have something to add to that. I did, as I mentioned earlier, I went on the online to the Alaska Earthquake Information Center as part of preparing for tonight's program. And by the way, you are listening to Raven Radio, KCAW, in Sitka. It's 2 minutes after 7 o'clock. We're talking about tsunami preparedness with Joel Curtis, warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service, and Sitka Fire Chief Dave Miller, Assistant Fire Chief Al Stevens, and Sitka Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt. And we'll be taking your calls in just a few minutes here. But Joel, I mentioned that I went online to the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, and as of noon last Friday, there have been 176 aftershocks with a magnitude of 2.1 to 5.1. 17 of them have been 4.0 and greater. And as you mentioned, we had a magnitude 5.5 aftershock a little before 6 a.m. Monday morning. And according to Mike West, the Alaska state seismologist, we can, quote, anticipate regular aftershocks for the next couple of months, though at a steadily declining rate. Felt aftershocks may be many weeks apart and may occur for years. He adds, quote, no one should be surprised if there is a magnitude 6 to 7 aftershock at some point. So that's information that I got off the Alaska Earthquake Information Center. So I'm with you, Joel. I'm not sure when we transition from aftershocks to totally new event. I think that's probably out of our collective expertise for sure. So,
well, one thing I have to add is that the 5.5, I was talking to a person in Port Alexander, and they said that it shook their house really, really good. So these things are still strong, and I think people are going to notice them.
Joel, when you debrief with the Alaska Tsunami Warning Center, or the warning, sort of the warning apparatus statewide, do you discuss the possibility of or the risk of another large quake, or has this event somehow set a clock back or something? Do you know?
I don't think that it sets any clock per se. I think it's generally understood that earthquake prediction is about as young a science as there can be. And people have, honestly, the leading scientists in earthquakes have very little confidence in being able to predict one. We will definitely, within the National Weather Service, go through this event and re-examine our procedures and look at, just like Dave and Al and the folks there in Sitka are going to do, we're going to look and see what worked well and what didn't work well and learn any lessons that we can from this. So that's something we normally do. We did some after the October 27th, and we will have a better tsunami warning program for it.
Okay. I have a listener question for you, Joel, from Roland, who sent this question in advance, and I wonder if you might know it or if again, we're a little bit out of our expertise, but how much time do you think we would have before a tsunami arrived if the quake occurred on the fault directly in front of Sitka Sound? Is there anything about the fault or the shape of the coastline, I think you used the word bathymetry, the bottom contour, in the sound that would lessen the threat of a tsunami?
Well, there are some things that would actually mitigate and take some energy out of the wave. At the same time, Sitka Sound is quite deep as you start coming up into the sound, and that won't take any energy out of it at all. I would say to Roland this, that tsunamis in the deep ocean travel at up to 500 miles per hour. In shallow water, tsunamis travel 30 and maybe even up to 40 miles per hour. So I think one could plot this out. I haven't made a measurement myself, but we could plot this out from the fault and have it go by Grusoff Island there and come up with a time. But I haven't made that calculation.
Okay. All right. Well, we have a caller on the line, Tom, in Eliason Harbor. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Joel and Ken, great program. Very timely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
First of all, I have one comment, and then I have a question for you right after. Comment is, I think the most important thing that we could do here in town is if we could find one person that couldn't get away and to maybe team up, do a buddy system, so that way, you know, we can get them off the dock or out of their apartment, be it they're elderly or just don't know. And if everybody just could get one person to help, I think that would help a lot.
That's a good idea.
Thanks.
A lot of nodding in agreement in the room. And you had a question as well?
Yeah. The question is, now, we hear a lot about aftershocks, but have you ever had anything reported where we get one big shaker, I mean, 7.5 or you can see it at 6.9, which I lived in Northridge. Now, have you ever had a bigger aftershock than the first huge one?
Okay. I will put that question to Joel Curtis, Tom, but I'm going to let you go so Joel can answer. Thanks very much for your question.
And thank you. Don't forget to comment either.
Right. That's a good idea. Joel, did you hear Tom's question just now?
Yeah, I did. I did hear it, and Tom, I don't have a really good answer for your question. To my own experience, I can't recall having a bigger aftershock than the original quake, but I don't want to say that with any confidence because, honestly, I would leave that for an earthquake scientist to answer that question correctly.
Okay. We have another call on line two. Debbie, I just want to ask you to hold just a minute more, but I wanted to ask Dave, Al, and Sheldon about this idea of a buddy system because I did read the dispatch reports on Monday, part of my routine job as a reporter in town, and there was a call came in from an elderly woman that night who couldn't manage her stairs, and police were unable to respond because of management of the evacuation and some other calls, and she was basically instructed to summon help from family or friends. And I was thinking, based on Tom's idea, maybe that's a good idea to kind of have connections you can count on in a crisis, and if you're worried you're not going to remember them, you know, maybe leave a list by your phone or something. What do you think, Sheldon?
Yeah, I was there that night, and I remember the call, and it's one of those things that just breaks your heart, and because you can't send anybody immediately to respond to make, and Yes, I mean, I think it's absolutely a good idea. And I think the first and thing that people should remember is that we are responsible for our own evacuation plan. We have all these fire department, police response out there to try to help people. But the thing to remember is if you feel a big quake like the one we had, is to initiate your own plan that you have in place, and hopefully you have a plan in place.
You guys feeling pretty good about how the communication system held up in town under the load of calls? Was there any sort of follow-up with the telephone company about that?
I think the thing that happened that night is as soon as the earthquake happened, we got bombarded by calls, both the fire department and the police department.
Correct.
And I'm guessing, you know, between the two of us, we probably answered, you know, 400 or 500 phone calls in the first 10 minutes.
And I will say that many of those calls were, was that an earthquake? Do we need to evacuate? Stuff
right.
like, simple stuff like that. So, and those calls came right up until we evacuated.
Right. Oh, yeah. They were, you know, still calling right to the minute that we evacuated. The big thing to remember is if you feel that quake, as I said, you know, if you feel that quake and you're concerned, evacuate. Don't call us or anything. Just evacuate. We can answer, you know, in that first 4 or 5 minutes, we can answer and say, yes, there was an earthquake. We really don't know any more than that until we get word from the warning center. And that took, I think that night it took 4 or 5 minutes, you know, 3, 4, or 5 minutes before we got that word and said, yeah, to 7-1 or 7-7, and we're in a warning. So if you're concerned about it to the point that you're thinking about calling, evacuate. If you get up there and you're the only one there, sneak back home and don't tell anybody you were there, you know. But you're better to be safe than sorry. If it would have been an earthquake that happened right off the coast and we had that quick wave coming in, you know, that 7 to 10 minutes wave, if we didn't know about, if we didn't get official word on it for 4 or 5 minutes before we could tell you, we're running too late then. You know, if it's that close, we may not be able to set off the sirens. There may have been damage to them or damage to the buildings, and we wouldn't be able to set them off. And then we'd be hurting.
Yeah, I'd just like to say, you know, Tom is right on with his comment about, you know, everybody helping each other here. So we actually have on our staff Donna Calistini. She does emergency program management for us. And she's, prior to this earthquake, she was actually starting a campaign of finding neighborhood collection points. So it's kind of like your neighborhood watch program, where you already have a plan in place and go to someone that you know, friend, relative, or a neighborhood that can house people that are on a high ground. So she'll be working throughout the rest of this year on getting that program up to speed.
I think we'll talk more about that, how we can help each other, help the community. I want to get this call on from Debbie. Hi, Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Appreciate the forum. It's a good opportunity for us all to learn something. Maybe this dates me, but I was in Juneau in the 1972 earthquake.
Wow.
No, it doesn't date me.
Really felt it. I lived in what was a pink building behind the governor's mansion, and we rocked and rolled. And I think I felt aftershocks for at least 2 weeks afterwards. It was really felt over there hard. In this earthquake, we were on the ferry out of Bellingham, headed north, and we didn't know anything about it till Saturday night when my husband happened to go to the purser's desk, and there was a printed readout about the earthquake when we first learned about it. And so Sunday morning when we got to Ketchikan, we called our daughter, who was at home, and she was up reading when the earthquake hit. And she looked at her smartphone to check the time because she said everybody always says, you know, they're 20 seconds, when she does not know how long until 11:58, you know, the seconds were, but the clock said 11:58, and then when it quit, it was 12 o'clock. So it was close to 2 minutes, or at least she felt it that long here at our house. And we were also living here in the 80s when, the late 80s, we had several tsunami warnings and earthquakes. And we did have some evacuations, although we lived on Edgecombe Drive and did not have to move, other people did come up to Edgecombe Drive at that time. So it's been quite a while since we've had a good shaker, and but we had some practice back in the 80s, but a lot of people are gone that lived here then. So anyway, I do want to tell you, I thank you for this forum. I thank everybody for the efforts they did, and, you know, you never know what you're going to do till you're in that spot. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your call, Debbie.
Okay, thanks.
The number is 747-5877 or 1-800-478-5877 outside of Sitka. You have a comment?
So I know exactly the building that Debbie is talking about, and I believe that's the Fosby Apartments, which is built into a hillside in Juneau. So I could understand why she really felt the shaking in that building.
Yeah. The type of structure probably plays a huge role in how you perceived the earthquake. We have a comment on Facebook or question. This is from Barbara. What is set up in the community for people that have pets? Where can they take them, as most, if not all, shelters don't allow people to bring their pets into them? Is that the case?
Well, go ahead.
I had an interesting conversation with Vicki Vosburg last night concerning that. And she fully understands that if the tsunami had hit, she was going to be one busy person. People really love their pets, and the pets evacuated with everyone else in their vehicles. Unfortunately, we don't have anything set up for pets. They're really we'll have to probably keep the pets in their cars or vehicles or whatever they drive. And the best thing is if you can stay with a friend, because pets are also going to need care and they're also going to need food. But I can imagine that had we actually had an event, you're probably going to have a lot of pets that are going to end up homeless. And Vicki knows this, and she wants to really work together to get a good plan going with that.
Vicki Vosburg, one of our local veterinarians. And I know that when just sort of during the debrief that everybody was experiencing just personally, a lot of people mentioned that something they either made sure to remember or totally forgot was pet food for their animals. Anyway, we've got another call, Catherine in Sitka. Hi, Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi there, thanks. Thanks, it's a wonderful, informative program. And I wanted to say the night of the tsunami, I feel that the police department and fire department did a great job. There's something that really concerned some friends and myself that I was trying to figure out who to call and tell. Did anybody notice the huge traffic jam at the roundabout about 15 minutes after the tsunami warning?
Oh, yeah.
About 12:15, if it had happened right outside and it had hit us in 10 minutes, I don't know how many hundreds of cars were backed up. And I'm not sure what the answer is. I just thought I'd throw that out there, that maybe as a town we could figure out what to do. I know we had to take a detour to pick up an elderly lady. It seemed like some people were going from south to north, some people from north to south, and people were going all over the place to pick up friends rather than people helping people right in their own neighborhoods. The other thing is, I guess we only have two designated tsunami-safe places, and not everybody needs to be inside a building at those times, but I was wondering if, as a town, we might want to consider building or creating a couple of extra tsunami high ground sites, one out the road each way, so that people could go different ways and we wouldn't have a traffic jam. We only have one road, and it seems like all 8,000 cars were out.
Yeah. I think all these guys are eager to take on this question, and it was on my list as well.
Okay.
Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
I think it's very true. We did notice that. I mean, if right away when the tsunami went off, a lot of people started evacuating right away when they felt, or not the tsunami, the earthquake, right away people started evacuating. And that sort of alleviated waiting for me to set off the siren. And then when the siren went off, ooh-yah. There were cars all over. I think the big thing to remember is, and I talked to one individual that said, you know, he it was a concern for him, and he said that him and his family took all three of their cars and tried to get to the high school. We're a small community, and like he said, I don't know how many thousands of cars were on the road that day, but we have to minimize that, and we have to somehow minimize that. If you only live a couple blocks from the high school and you're going to the high school, maybe you don't need to take your car up there. you know, you don't necessarily need to go to those evacuation centers. All you need to really do is go to high ground. And there again, we've been talking about it. If you have a friend that lives in high ground and you can get there in, you know, two or three blocks, that's a great thing. You don't need to drive through town and do that. I understand wholly, and we're talking about the traffic concerns because they are a big concern. It's if we're in a if we have a wave right outside that's going to come in, and we only have 7 or 8 minutes, I'm not sure there's a huge solution to that, but we're going to try to figure that out.
So, Chief Schmidt, when the DOT built the roundabout, they gave us instructions about how to drive through it. Did they give the police any instructions about how to manage it during a situation like this?
No, we haven't talked to them specifically about that. It's a little bit more. You know, part of what we're talking about tomorrow is how to, if we're going to try to direct people one way or another, can we do that in the roundabout? Can we station people inside the roundabout? So that's a, you know, a learning curve for us.
Yeah, I think Dave and Catherine, the caller, she brought up an interesting point. You know, just about everybody knows somebody who lives on shore knows somebody who lives upland and probably close enough to assist in kind of a short notice evacuation. Did you have anything on traffic, Al?
You know, this happened at midnight. You know, on any given weekday, how much traffic actually goes across the bridge to Japonski Island. You know, Search Hospital, DOT, airport, and all this. If this traffic jam, we left the fire station. The chief and I left the fire station with 9 minutes to go. We were one of the last ones to go through the roundabout. Yeah, there was a traffic jam, but the last vehicle was at the roundabout heading up Lake Street. We were able to go HPR and get up to Kiku Shaheen fairly quickly. So, yeah, there was a traffic jam, but it was flowing fairly well during the incident. So,
yeah, I heard there were people up on the hill, up on the cemetery downtown, who were cheering when that last car got through the roundabout before time. We have Tom on the line. Hi, Tom.
Bob, this is Tom Arthelarsa at Community Hospital, and I want to thank, you know, Sheldon and Dave and Al. You know, over the years we've done a lot of work planning for the you know, this kind of a situation, and it worked. Maybe it might have worked a little bit too well, but you know, 10 years ago, Scott Berlinski, we had a little group together for 2 or 3 days of training for, you know, post earthquake, you know, inspections. We kind of grabbed all the engineers in town and learned how to, you know, look at structures that, you know, might or might not have survived the earthquakes. But you know, one of the things that we had going on is we've taught people that they need to go to the high schools and or to the high school or the schools or the Kim Sham. But I think that we need to, you know, maybe adjust that a little bit to where people are, you know, told to look at where they're at. I actually had some friends that lived in the Lance Drive area that drove into town to the high school when they had Lance Drive and the Hillside Subdivision to drive up. You know, I guess, you know, one of the other questions or question that I had, maybe for Joel Curtis or you know, somebody there, is that Charles Hallett, our disaster preparedness coordinator at the hospital, you know, supplied us a website that can actually tell you, you know, where you're at in Sitka and what your elevation is. And I know, you know, like the hospital is at, you know, 56 feet, you know, the second floor. You know, where I live down on HPR is at 61 feet. You know, the high school's at 61 or 62 feet. You know, so those are very, you know, high areas that you really don't need to go down onto HPR or Sawmill Creek to do anything with. And then, you know, I guess the thing that I'm really, you know, kind of wondering about is, with all the software, computer programs involved, is there something out there that shows you where the, you know, where a tsunami would go?
Tom, we thought you'd never ask.
I think one of the big things, first, you can find out how high your house is by going to www.geoplanner.com.
Planer. Planer. P-L-A-N-E-R.
Yeah, .com. And that will tell you the elevation of your property there. The University of Alaska Fairbanks is doing a bathymetric inundation study, and have been for a number of years. I checked on that today, and they're saying that it should be shortly done now. And I think this was a big push to get it moving along. And that will tell us if a wave size of, say, 10 feet came in, where that would inundate what parts of town. Problems are is you never know what size of wave is going to be coming. We fought in the Japanese earthquake. We followed that wave all the way around the Aleutian chain and everything, so we knew that the wave wasn't going to be very big. But if it happens right out in front of us, we're not going to know how big of a wave we potentially will have until it hits land somewhere and we get somebody saying, hey, we had a 10-foot wave. And as Joel said, even then it's going to matter on how deep the water is right in front of it, how far the runoff is, on the shore and all that stuff. We'll be able to, at some point in time, hopefully if it's a long-distance wave, we'll be able to say, oh, there's a 10-foot wave coming. It's hit the Aleutian chain at 10 feet. We should be higher than 60 feet or something, but there's no accuracy there. So the state recommends on their websites that you're 100 feet in elevation or 2 miles back from the shore. Now, we realize that Kiku Shaheen is at 75 feet and the high school is between 75 and 85 feet in elevation, but those are the highest places that we can get large amounts of people in an area to keep them warm and dry and everything else. Now, I read about Petersburg today in one of the newspapers, and it said that they evacuate their people to a ball field that's above 100 feet or at 100 feet or somewhere right there. The problem is there's no, they can't keep them warm, they can't keep them dry, there's nothing there to keep them, warm in. Whether we were ever to get a 100-foot wave or a wave that would affect us at 85 feet or so, it's anybody's guess, but we're betting that hopefully not.
I think that's probably why some people do come to the high school, to the schools. They choose to go there because they know it's a place to be comfortable to wait it out. Tom, I'm going to let you go because we're having more calls.
Tom,
appreciate your call.
All right, thank you, guys.
Yeah, I waited in the car a little bit that night and eventually went to Kiku Shaheen to hang out with you guys. It was more fun. We have Lisa on the line. Lisa, you there?
Hi. I work with the local food network and also with the Alaska Food Policy Council. And I talked with Dave last week, and I think it's important for people to realize as they're putting together their emergency kits that there is no food cache stored at any of the schools for this kind of situation. And so people really need to be prepared. Whether they store it at a friend's house or in their garage if they're up high enough, but to be thinking about what you need. And the ready.gov website does a terrific job, both focused on water as well as food in terms of what you're going to need.
All right. That's a good observation, Lisa. Thanks very much. A lot of preparedness does involve kind of personal preparedness, and I think that dawned on people this time. But there is the issue that Lisa brought out, that there isn't a public food supply except what might be available in grocery stores or whatever should a disaster strike. But at least one of our stores is probably in a hazard area, to say the least. And that I'm going to just sort of match up Lisa's question to this question on Facebook from Brent, who would like to know who is in charge about making decisions about resource allocations and decisions related to citizen safety during a natural disaster like a tidal surge, because Sitka is potentially cut off from the rest of the world during a natural disaster. Our airport would probably be inundated, and he's just concerned about who is in charge and what's their authority to make decisions about that. I think Lisa made the point that a lot of us should probably take some personal responsibility there, but what about public allocation of resources?
Well, I can talk on that. Dave is the Sitka City and Borough Emergency Manager. So reality is that, he is in charge for making the decisions. However, we can tell the public that when we go up to Kiku Shaheen as a fire department or a police department, we're establishing what's called an emergency operations center. And one of the very first phone calls and contacts that we make is with the State Emergency Response Center. There is a plan because we're going to be reliant on other communities for these food sources and medications and things that people are going to need because most of all of our stores are in low-lying areas, so we got to expect that there's going to be some damage to those. How it's going to get into Sitka, as you said, the airport is probably going to be inundated, and who knows what shape the runway will be in. So in our plan, we're working very closely with the Coast Guard, for example, because we know everything is going to have to come in by rotary wing. That night, the Coast Guard did a tremendous job. They got their helicopters in there and got a fuel truck up to the soccer field, and that's going to be their refuel area because you can imagine there's not going to be much fuel left by the airport for them to get fuel. The ball fields up there in the emergency plan are designated for rotary wing. Juneau Air National Guard is set to start shuttling with Blackhawk helicopters. And so those all have to be done through the State Emergency Response Center. It's going to take time, though. People have to understand that, for about the first 24 to 48 hours, we are isolated. It's going to take time to mobilize things into Southeast to get them into Sitka. And we're not the only community that'll be devastated by this. We have outlying communities that we're responsible for calling. Port Alexander, Pelican, Craig, all these communities, we're all going to be impacted.
All right. So that one of the comments that one of the sound bites on our newscast from John Straley, he was interviewed after this because there was a thread on his Facebook page about what people took with them when they left, and he said just so eloquently that we got all the benefits of a disaster and none of the real sorrow of it. We got to we got to experience kind of a bit of the panic. We got to experience the quake and the feeling of leaving home or taking in friends if we were on high ground. But the water didn't come, and now we have really kind of a remarkable opportunity to kind of assess all this. But it sounds like, Dave Miller, you're the pointy end here, that you're the contact point with state emergency right. services, and the help that would come to Sitka would be directed through you and the organization that fans out below
right.
you.
We meet... The state gets together with all the communities that are directly involved with emergencies of one type or another, whether they be out on the Gulf or all around the state on the shores. And we talk about these things twice a year. We get together for a week twice a year and deal with these situations. So it's not an unknown. Like Al said, they're not going to be here maybe tomorrow morning, but they're on their way, and the state at this point in time is trying to come up with a plan for food supplies for a period of time to be stored in two different places around the state so that they could be taken out right away to these communities that really need them. It ran into a little hiccup, but they're still working on it, trying to figure out a way to have food available for these communities that need it in case of an emergency.
All right. You're listening to a call-in program on tsunami preparedness on Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka at 732. Our phone number here is 747-5877 or 1-800-478-5877. And we do have an open line, but we've got a caller on line two. Pamela, you're on the air.
Hi. Great show. Glad you had it. And I think all the emergency people in town responded just great. But I had a question about why they waited 10 minutes.
I can answer that.
Ten minutes from the earthquake to the
right.
sounding of the sirens.
I left my house within probably 3 minutes of the quake because I actually had my bags packed. But I understand that you needed to take your emergency vehicles up to higher ground. Mm-hmm. But then what if during the traffic jam there had really been a tsunami?
We knew as soon as we got a fax or whatever from the or email from the tsunami center up in Palmer, we knew right away within that 4 or 5 minute time. You know, when they told us that it was a 7.7 quake, it was located where it was located. They predicted that time how long it's going to be before a wave would hit certain areas, And we knew at that time that a wave wouldn't hit Sitka until 1:40 or until 12:45 or 0045 in the morning. So we knew we had a little bit of time. We gave ourselves a little bit of time to get, like you said, to get emergency vehicles going. You got to remember, at that time in the morning, there are two police officers on duty with a jailer and a dispatcher, and there's one fire guy on duty. If we have the time to be able to do that, we like to be able to get our people mobilized so that they're helping us to move all our equipment. We have, six pieces of equipment plus trailers and everything else to get moved.
Yeah.
If we don't give them that time, we're going to really be stuck way back in the traffic line. We had about, I think I counted 55 of our staff, paid and volunteers, show up that night to help out. Police department had
13
show up to help out. You know, all that takes a little bit of time, like the traffic jam, trying to direct traffic. With only two officers on, it's a tough thing. But as officers came in, they were put out to different points to help direct traffic. But by that time, I mean, we're already moving full bore. But that's why we waited. I decided to wait until quarter after to try to get movement going.
All right.
Because I didn't know that they had given you that.
Right. I understand.
Okay.
Usually if we have enough time, if it's an earthquake that's happened right off the coast and it was that strong, we're going to set the sirens off right away if we're able to. And I keep telling people, there's always that chance that the sirens may not go off. Don't wait for the sirens if it's that strong. Mm-hmm. If it's that strong, we could lose a tower, we could lose our systems. Electrical systems to be able to set off those sirens. So if it's that strong, get going. Don't wait for me.
Yeah, because it was surreal when I got up on Halibut Point Road. I was the only car, and that just was so strange. But
so then, did you wonder if you really felt an earthquake or not?
Well, I know. Bizarre.
Pamela, I think we could all take a lesson from you. You mobilized and you were prepared, and I think that's the message we're trying to help convey here tonight. So
yeah.
give yourself a pat on the back.
Thanks for my animals and, with kitty litter and dog food and cat food and, their kennels in case we didn't end up in the school. You know, they could be inside in their kennels and stuff.
That's good thinking.
Thanks
very much for your call.
So, right, so something that people don't realize in the emergency planning of things is that, for example, our public works group, they did a tremendous job that night. We have to prepare with heavy equipment. And without the heavy equipment, none of our emergency equipment is going to be able to move. So they were able to mobilize and get heavy equipment to high ground that night. That's something people just don't realize is they're driving their vehicles up to the high schools. Had we had a tsunami, their vehicles aren't going anywhere.
Right. I had a question. Joel, are you still with us from Juneau? Joel, you still there? We might have lost Joel, our warning coordination meteorologist, but I'll pose this question to the three of you. I imagine this was about the tightest timeline that would enable you to make that kind of decision to mobilize equipment before sounding a general alarm. At some point, you're just going to have to say your 55 paid and volunteer staff are just going to have to get to high ground.
Right.
Did that kind of calculus go through your mind?
Oh, yeah, we discussed that. We took 2 seconds and discussed that. As soon as we got in, we got there about the same time and said, do we wait or do we set it off right now? It's great if we have the time. If we don't, it worked out really well. We just talked to the fireside part of our crew just days before about where to go in an emergency, dealing with the shootings and all that other stuff. Yeah. So they were already prepared.
Right.
It was fresh on their minds.
Chief Schmidt, I had a question for you about Code Red, the call burst system. Does that require sending somebody into dispatch to trigger that signal?
Yeah, what happened is when this happened, right after the earthquake happened, we were inundated with phone calls. And we had one dispatcher, and they're trying to take the phone calls. And she immediately have to let the phone ring so she can call somebody else in. And as soon as we got another dispatcher in, she was taking calls too, but they at some point had to stop taking calls so that they could make a recording and put the recording, the Code Red recording, out to the public.
Mm-hmm. But you might be in the same circumstance if it were one of these, if it were a scenario that Joel was talking about where we had a strong earthquake and we all felt it was on its way, then that warning might you know, you as chief might say, don't go in, or, you know, get up.
I think that the time frame that we had was about right. We were able to get our prisoners relocated and able to get our equipment and our emergency communications equipment up to KGH. But I remember there was about 5 minutes left to go, and the phone was still ringing off the hook. Right. I had to grab the dispatcher and go at that point.
Right. Joel, you back with us?
Yeah, sure am.
Yeah, the question was, what is the tightest timeline that we would have warning? I mean, this was about 45 minutes from the quake to the ETA of the wave, and I guess we got notified by the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center about 4 to 5 minutes after the earthquake happened. But is there, do you have a sense of what the tightest window of warning would be in a situation like this?
Well, the Tsunami Warning Center is laboring ferociously as soon as they get notification of an earthquake to get the warning out, and I believe their guideline is no longer than 5 minutes.
Okay. So,
but with a local tsunami, I mean, that could be out the door. I mean, you could get the wave sooner than the Tsunami Warning Center can issue the warning.
Yeah, I think that's been a suggestion here tonight, that it, whatever disaster would be upon us might be here before the warning arrives in certain circumstances. So anyway, we're going to...
Again, with that 20-second quake or difficulty standing up, that's the one.
So this one, even though it was tight, there was a little bit of, I don't know if luxury is the right word, but a little bit of time built in that allowed Sitka to mobilize its public resources. We've got Dave on the line. Hello, Dave.
You're on the air? I was just going to say that you should get an emergency kit for your pet as well as for yourself. If you have that already set up in advance, it'll be a lot better for your animal. And you just would put dog food, a bunch of dog food, and the things that your dog was going to need in that kit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think now is the time to think about everyone in your household who will be leaving with you.
Dog.
Yeah, thanks very much for your call.
Sure.
And we've got John on the line. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Okay, yes, thanks. So have we planned as a community to move assets like heavy equipment, bulldozers and backhoes and that kind of stuff up? And also, are the transfer companies that, say, may have vans of food and that kind of stuff, are they keen on moving that to high ground, given enough notice?
We've talked to, over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, we've talked to all of these companies. Most of the construction companies in the city, they know that we hope to stage most of all of that heavy equipment up in the very back of the new ball fields. That area is designed to hold there all of that equipment, because we know that one of the big things that arises after a tsunami should hit, or an earthquake even, is, you know, the debris that's on the roads and everything. That we plan for that. We have a plan for that. Food-wise, as long, you know, in this case, we just didn't have everybody didn't have the time to get stuff organized, to get going. If we have, you know, a wave like the Japanese wave, and we know it's going to be big, we have all of that time to get all that stuff moving, and I think we've talked to just about all the companies now about pre-planning and all that stuff, as long as we have the time to do it.
Great.
Right. Thanks for your question, John. The number is 747-5877 or 1-800-478-5877. And I'd like to ask callers, when you're put on hold, you will be able to hear us, so please turn down your radio, and that way we won't get the feedback in your head when you bring you on the air. Joel, I had another... I'll wait, Joel. I wanted to bring a question from Facebook here for the guys. If a large tsunami wave were to enter Sitka Sound, this is from Keith, I'm wondering if the city and or Coast Guard has a plan in place to check on the welfare of outlying island residents, and that a large wave could possibly destroy docks and vessels and stranding people and preventing them from reaching town and safety. Is there a plan for the inner island neighborhoods?
We don't have a plan per se for each community, but one of the things that we are responsible as Sitka, during these warnings, is that we are have a list of communities that we do contact. We have emergency numbers for them. And so the engineer that's on duty, as you can imagine, not only is toning out for everyone to come to the fire hall to get equipment and things for high ground, but it's also going down the list and making sure that they're contacting every one of these communities. As we mobilize and head up to Kiku Shaheen and open up the Emergency Operations Center, we continue to stay in contact and update these communities.
Okay.
I think one of if they're talking about the islands right off the, you know, our local islands.
Yes.
The Coast Guard's in the air. Their goal is to, right after the wave, if a wave should hit, is to fly over Sitka, give us an update on what the area looks like. If the roads are open or not open, what's demolished or not demolished, and hopefully in that whole time they'll be able to look at the island areas. The thing that we learned from the Japanese earthquake was that the debris that's going to be in the water is going to limit us from going anywhere. It was just packed. If you can just imagine all the trees and containers and cars and everything else that could be floating in the bays, we're not going to be able to get out to those islands real quick. And there again, the Coast Guard's got the responsibility for all of the communities in Southeast, so they'll be looking at those communities. They'll be taking off and looking at those communities too. So to say that we'll be able to get out to each island and check on it, it will probably be a while.
Yeah, this is something that sometimes has crossed through my mind. I don't have island property, but it's not easy to rule it out, living in a beautiful place like Sitka, getting a place on an island. But there must be, some of these islands must have, you would think, adequate high ground. And you would hope that island residents, like anybody else, would kind of, consider where their immediate refuge is if they have time.
If I could, to get off the island real quick, I'll tell you, before we lose Joel again or we ran out of time with Joel. Joel is one of the greatest guys to deal with. I mean, he comes to our community once a year or so and does lectures for us about tsunamis and earthquakes and weather. If you haven't ever made one of those, when he's here, you should go make one of those things. It's very informative. He's very knowledgeable on those things, and we learn a lot from him then. And when we're on the phone with him during one of these scenarios that's happening, It's a huge relief. He has access to all of that stuff that we don't have. You know, he can call up north and be talking to somebody that's looking at a screen saying, this is where it's at and everything else. We're busy. We don't have that access to be able to do that. But he has the access to be able to do that, and he keeps us informed on everything that's happening to the minute. He is the greatest relief once I get him on the phone, because he knows what's happening, he has the ability to look outside of what we see.
This is a radio station. You normally got to pay for that kind of publicity.
Yeah, thank you, Dave.
If there is a God in my eyes, Joel, you are one of them, let me tell
you. Oh, no.
Well, I would second that. I always enjoy talking to Joel. But in all seriousness, Joel, especially somebody in your business, because when you're not working with emergency preparedness and the emergency warning system, you are a weatherman and you make daily predictions, some of them dire. And I wanted to ask you and also our panel here about the idea of the never cry wolf syndrome and how we combat it. You can never take issuing this kind of warning lightly. And you said at the very beginning of this broadcast, it's automated. If the earthquake is of a certain size, there's an automatic warning going out within 300 miles. But Joel, do you ever worry, or do you ever try and calculate the possibility of too many warnings that don't result in an actual emergency, and what the impact might be on when it really happens?
Yeah, the technical term for that are false alarms. In
yeah.
other words, we issue a warning and it doesn't pan out. Do I worry about it? Sure, absolutely. I don't issue the tsunami warnings, but I know the Tsunami Warning Center is concerned about this too. The one thing that we have to say on the outer coast, the immediate area on the ocean, you can't take that Fairweather Queen Charlotte Fault for granted at all. You know, like I said earlier tonight, it's a strike slip type fault, but one of these days it's going to trip a landslide, and so then what? You just have to respect that. And so on the certainly on the outside waters on the immediate coast, just have to take care of business. And I know Tsunami Warning Center thinks about it, but they really have to issue the automated warning, particularly if it's a very big earthquake and very close.
I think Joel used a good word on that one, and that was a respect it. You know, when you look at Japan, who is one of the nations who's probably best prepared for tsunamis and earthquakes in the world, and look what happened to them. So, yeah, you're right, Joel. You do have to respect it.
Definitely.
In the waves that happen long distance, you know, the Japanese and everything, we didn't set off our sirens. And we, Al and I spoke about that, and Joel, we were on the phone with him, and he's saying, should you, and we're asking him, should we not? Should we or should we not? Trying to make decisions on whether to set off the sirens all the way across. And my concern is huge on setting it off too many times. I was here in the late 80s when we set them off 3 or 4 times in a row. One time we were doing a test of the sirens, and 30 seconds later we had a real thing happen where we had to set them off. So I don't want to set them off too much. So if the siren does go off, there's a good chance that something could be happening. So don't stand around and wait. Get going. And when you hear the chimes, people ask how to know when we're sort of saying all is clear. When you hear the chimes, those noon chimes, that's sort of an international thing saying all's clear. So when you hear that after the sirens go off, that means you can go back home and everything's looking better.
All right. Well, we have 9 more minutes to go. I've got that's Fire Chief Dave Miller, Assistant Fire Chief Al Stevens, and Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt are here in the studio to take your calls about emergency preparedness, 747-5877. And National Weather Service Warning Coordination Meteorologist Joel Curtis is on the phone with us from Juneau. You couldn't have a better group of people to talk about preparedness how the community can do better and how we personally can do better. I did have a couple of more things on Facebook, and this is related to being swamped by calls. This is from Robin, and she's relatively new to Alaska. She's a teacher in Port Alexander who happened to be in Sitka staying at the Super 8 that night. She had 2 children with her, and she kept hearing on the media how she shouldn't call 911. But she's from Iowa, and she was clueless.
They don't have tsunamis in Iowa.
No tsunamis in Iowa, and she says she feels guilty for asking for help. And I guess when you're saying don't call the police or don't call the fire department, it's not a hey, we're busy, we can't help you. It's you are trying to kind of filter the need to know from the people who probably already do know,
right?
That kind of thing,
right? We're going to get calls, and we understand that. But if you're just calling us to say, was that an earthquake? We all felt the same thing. But if you really need to talk to us, we're going to answer the phone. We have to answer the phone in case it's another true emergency happening, a heart attack or whatever. We're going to answer the phone. But it really does. If you're calling to say, where should I go, or you really don't know, that's the type of thing that we want to call. But if you do know where to go and you're just calling to say, hey, was that really an earthquake? Should I evacuate? You should be evacuating already.
And part of the reason for the code red is to try to get information to people so that they don't have to make that call.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to make that as fast as we can. Originally when we got it, we didn't use it very much. We only used it once, I think, in the first one. My goal now is to use it a lot. It's easy to do.
It's been beneficial, too. Yeah. I will say that at times. It's really reduced the number of informational type calls, people calling us to find out what's going on.
If we could, in a long range tsunami, if we could do it every 20 or 30 minutes, man, I'd be happy just to keep people informed what's happening. It's easy to do once we get it going.
I'm guessing that Robin should not feel guilty.
No, not at all.
Trying to get through and get good information. I had another question asked via email in advance. This is from Kermit, and this is territory we haven't covered yet. Again, we tend to think of all, we're reacting to the event we, most of us, experienced on January 4th, but this kind of scenario, I remember in the 80s, the tsunami warning happened during the day, mm-hmm. and there might have been a cruise ship in port.
I think so.
But Kermit asks, what if a major quake happened when a cruise ship was in town and everyone tried to use their cell phones at once and the system crashed? Would handheld VHF radio be a viable alternative for the public? Should we encourage the use of VHF radio?
Oh, yeah. I think VHF radio is going to be the biggest way to go at that time, because we just have to have a cruise ship in now and without an emergency, and we run out of cell phone coverage. VHF radios are a great way to go. The new emergency radios that you crank up and you get going, that's going to be a great way to go, because if we are inundated by a wave, Raven Radio has the radio in a box scenario that we can set up. It will take a little bit of time to get it set up, but we'll be able to broadcast in, just like we are right now, talking, you know, on a radio and keeping you informed about what's going on. There are a variety of ways that way. You know, I heard one community's got Twitter or whatever. I mean, I even tried to read up on that. I got to find some 10-year-old, 11-year-old kid to be able to explain it to me and how to make it work. But we're going to look at all those ways to be able to keep people informed. And if there is a cruise ship out there and we have, you know, that 2,000 people, if it's a long-range wave coming in, they're going to leave. Mm-hmm. They're just going to drop, really, just leave everybody on shore and take off to get to hot, deep water.
I seem to recall that might have been what happened.
Then the people that are on shore, we'll be trying to herd them up to up to the high school, get them walking so that they can get up there.
But Kermit's question does illustrate a point. The communication system worked pretty well. I mean, I was able to talk with you, Dave, mm-hmm. From the radio station here about, you know, when we should notify the public and things. And as far as I know, everybody was able to communicate with friends and sort of engage their buddy systems. But that might not be the case the next time. There could be situations like just a system overload if there was a cruise ship in port, or the cell tower gets knocked out somehow.
We've actually been working for about the past 6 months. And the February 1st and 2nd, we have a major disaster communications drill. So the timing of this incident was just perfect for this. And the communications drill is going to involve agencies from all over in Sitka. The Mountain Rescue Group, they're going to set up their repeater systems. Coast Guard's going to set up a deployable system. And just on and on, the ham operators, for example, we'll get them back together again. So we're going to really test the communication system in Sitka.
All right. And I think Raven Radio will be involved with our portable transmitter.
Yes, absolutely, you will be.
Trying to make that happen.
We're going to try and squeeze in one more call here. This is Tom in Sitka. Hey, Tom.
Yeah, hey, guys. Besides the comment suggestion about, you know, the buddy system, because God knows that could help, is for over abundance of phone calls, I may be on here, but I know if you call 911, they have a pre-recorded message that says it's not an emergency call. Now, my thesis is during an emergency, could they not have somebody at the dispatch make a message that says we had a tsunami at high, have a true emergency, please stay on the line.
Okay. Tom, we are getting about every other word, but I think we got the gist of that question, and I'll pass it to Sheldon Schmidt. Thank you for both your calls this evening. I think Tom was driving at the idea that
recording a quick message and putting it on the line.
Yeah, just letting people know the basics so that a human could interact with real emergencies. Is that even possible? Is it possible to build that in?
I don't think we have a capacity right now. I mean, that's the whole idea of the Code Red, is to do that so that we can limit the number of calls to real emergencies. If I don't have a quick answer for you, but it's something that we can look into.
All right.
Then you're talking about taking people aside and having them do a recording. I don't know if you'd want to do that at the time. You'd have to have some pre-recorded stuff. yeah. ready.
Okay. Well, that's going to do it, guys, for us. Just in the last 30 seconds here, is there anything you want to leave the town with? I think we've had pretty attentive listeners tonight.
I think the thing that, if I can say anything, if you don't have a kit to prepare to evacuate if you need to, if you come down the fire hall in our front area there, we have some written information that the state put out about earthquakes and tsunamis and what you should put in your seven-day kit, or go to www.ak-prepared.com. It's online, and you'll be able to get that. And I see you have a question over there. I love the question because it came up in our LEPC meeting. If you're gauging your evacuation on the Coast Guard Cutter Maple sitting out there, you're not going to leave until they leave. They take a lot longer to get going than the 45 minutes that we had. They have to get a crew together. They have to get it started, get it going, get moving. If you're waiting for them to move, the wave may already be here.
All right. Well, thanks very much. Sheldon?
Yeah, one final thought. Just want to thank Dave and the fire department. I thought they did a great job. I think the community did a great job. This was a real event, real emergency, as you pointed out. And we didn't have a lot of panic-driven car crashes or stuff like that. I just thought the community did a great job.
All right. Let's hope it all goes this well. Next time we have to deal with this, which we inevitably will. And we'll have links to all the websites we talked about on our website, kcaw.org, Geoplanar, and the preparedness site you mentioned, Dave, and the Alaska Earthquake Information Center. My guests have been Fire Chief Dave Miller, Assistant Fire Chief Al Stevens, Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt, and Joel Curtis, who is the NOAA Warning Coordination Meteorologist in Juneau. Thanks very much, Joel. And
thank you.
Thanks to all you guys.
Thanks, Joel.
Listening to Raven Radio, KCAW, in Sitka. And